Good afternoon. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of Health Styles that's brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College. The healthcare reform law called the Affordable Care Act was intended to reform the insurance industry, reduce the number of uninsured, slow the growth of healthcare costs, and begin to reform our healthcare system. But a new book entitled The Battle Over Healthcare argues that it actually rewards those who have made healthcare unaffordable, wasteful, and sometimes harmful. I'm really pleased to have one of the book's authors on today's Health Styles program to discuss the book. Rosemary Gibson has led national healthcare initiatives for the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and is the author of two other books on healthcare safety, quality, and overtreatment. She's also the editor for a series called Less is More in the journal Archives of Internal Medicine. Rosemary, thank you so much for coming back on Health Styles. You've been on this program before talking about your other books, and I'm really grateful that you've come back on today.
Diane, I'm honored to be here. Thank you.
Now, let me just tell listeners that she is the lead author. The co-author is J.P. Singh, and the book is published by Roman Littlefield. And again, it's called The Battle Over Healthcare. So I do want to alert listeners that we are recording this interview before the Supreme Court has announced its decision about whether it will overturn all or part of the Affordable Care Act. But while the book's primary focus is on the Affordable Care Act and how that evolved, how it got formed, and a critique of that, the critique itself and the book's recommendations, I believe, will be relevant regardless of the Supreme Court decision. So, Rosemary, let's start talking a little bit about why your book will remain relevant, even if the Supreme Court rules that the Affordable Care Act in part or in whole, in total, is unconstitutional.
What we wrote in The Battle Over Healthcare, Diana, was the underlying other story that hasn't gotten a lot of attention. And that's the role of the healthcare industry, particularly the Wall Street-backed healthcare industry, whether it's hospitals, drug companies, device manufacturers, and what was their role in healthcare reform? What did they get from it, and what does it mean for the long term and also the short term? It's an untold story that didn't receive much attention, and we try to shine a light on it in The Battle Over Healthcare.
So the issues around these various sectors that were involved in influencing what we ended up with healthcare reform, the special interest groups. Those special interests are one of the reasons, one of the reasons why we're in the shape we are today with a healthcare system that's out of control, doesn't have good outcomes, and is way too costly. That's one of your premises, right?
That's right. Looking at this industry, we noticed uncanny similarities with the Wall Street banks. Both the healthcare industry and the financial system have price bubbles, toxic assets. They're too big to fail. They have privatized gains and socialized losses, lots of conflicts of interest. And these are huge drivers that explains why we have healthcare today. When it comes to the healthcare reform law, the negotiations with the drug companies, some of your listeners may remember that President Obama said we're going to allow for reimportation of drugs. Mm-hmm. We're going to negotiate drug prices. But in the end, the public got none of that because the industry put pressure. So we have, in the end, what the industry wanted.
Now, you do speak to the paradox of having the Affordable Care Act appearing to rein in not just the insurers, but the pharmaceutical industry, hospitals, even organized medicine for that matter. And yet actually the act benefits all of these players. Can you give us an example of each of these sectors? So you give us another one on the insurance industry. Let's start there.
Well, what's so interesting is that there, contrary to what certainly I believe, when I started peeling back the layers, there's nothing in the healthcare reform law that stops the increase in private health insurance premiums.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
When Secretary Sebelius was interviewed on the news, And she was asked this question, what should people do if their private health insurance premiums keep going up? She said, well, you should contact your state legislature mm-hmm. and your governor and get rate review passed in your state. Mm-hmm. So that was a surprise to me, and I'm sure it's a surprise to a lot of Americans to know there's nothing to stop the increase in premiums. Now, the health care reform law tries to put subsidies in place, but there's two things about that. Mm-hmm. One is the subsidies won't be for everybody. So if you take a 58-year-old woman who earns $48,000 a year, she'll have to pay more than $10,100 for health insurance. Mm. That's according to the Kaiser Family Foundation subsidy calculator. And for others, still there's nothing to stop the increase in costs. So that was a huge eye-opener that I think we really just have not contended with.
And you also point out that by covering more of the current uninsured and the mandate for insurance coverage, it actually can become a boon to the insurance companies.
Well, what happened with the health care reform law, which I'm really supportive of making sure everyone has access to care mm-hmm. and insurance coverage, is that with a stroke of a pen, we gave 32 million new customers to an industry that doesn't have a good track record at all in affordability or safety, for that matter. And it's a huge challenge. So they got a lot. And the question that we put in the battle over healthcare is, what did the public get for it in return for more accountability from the system on price and quality?
Now, give the example of how the hospital industry actually benefits from this, even though we're trying to control costs by trying to reduce how much spending goes on by hospitals for hospital care.
Well, one of the good things for hospitals is, they see a lot of uninsured people, and they don't get paid for that. Mm. And with healthcare reform, the good news is that patients won't have to come in if they're uninsured because they'll have insurance and won't feel as if they're, outcasts or people who can't pay because they don't have insurance. That will be stopped, so people will be treated more equally, and that's exactly what should happen. But what the hospital industry did is, we document in the battle over healthcare the enormous waste in how hospitals spend the public's money, whether it's through private insurance premiums or Medicare. They got out from under the Independent Payment Advisory Board, which is to try to control Medicare spending, which we think is a good thing.
Explain that board a little, yeah.
Yeah, the Independent Payment Advisory Board is a part of healthcare reform that would kick in if Medicare spending increased more than a certain, growth in the level of national income. And we have to do something about Medicare. And, of course, the industry fought it because they want no constraints whatsoever on how much they can spend, because all that spending turns into revenue for them, and they don't want any control over how much money that they can make. But where does that leave us? It leaves us with nothing to stop the growth in how much Medicare is spending. And that's just, we all know it's unsustainable. So we're really in a conundrum here. But the hospitals got out from under the Independent Payment Advisory Board. They have an exemption in the law through the end of the decade, assuming, of course, the Independent Payment Advisory Board provision stays intact. And there are a lot of people that are trying to get rid of it, the pharmaceutical industry in particular. I think that would be a big loss.
And my understanding is the Republicans are really trying to kill it, and that doesn't make sense to me.
Well, the Republicans want to support industry and support revenue growth, but we have to find a way to curtail spending. And I don't think the way to do it is to put the onus on ordinary citizens and seniors. Mm-hmm. The onus is on the industry. That it's been documented clearly that about 30% of the money we spend on healthcare is waste, a combination of fraud, overtreatment, gross inefficiency in how money is spent, because they haven't had to really work. It's not been used well, let's put it that way. And we document that clearly in the battle over healthcare.
Now, you also give some examples, have some space dedicated to talking about organized medicine's role, particularly the American Medical Association, in terms of trying to benefit from the Affordable Care Act and to shape what went into it.
Yes, the doctors were divided over whether or not to support health care reform, and in the end, the American Medical Association did support health care reform, which is a good thing. But a challenge is that the AMA has been supportive of specialty care over the years, to the exclusion of primary care. And what we have is a healthcare system and healthcare reform that is like a house without a first floor, and that first floor is primary care that everybody needs. So we have to find a way to balance out how much primary care and specialty care we have with more emphasis on primary care.
And they play a role in setting what the value of services are by physicians, correct?
That's exactly. The AMA has a special committee that really has had a huge impact, very quietly so, but profound impact on where dollars in healthcare go. And it explains in part why we have why specialists are paid a lot more than primary care physicians. And it explains then why we have so few primary care physicians, too much specialty care, and in the end, overuse of certain types of back surgery, heart bypass surgery that's been well documented.
So, Rosemary, your book really lays out quite nicely some of the paradox of how the Affordable Care Act was supposed to reform our healthcare system in a variety of ways, and yet ended up with some compromises that really undercut its ability to do that. And you have in your book a paragraph that deals with the idea of people's commitment to a truth, to a higher purpose, if you will, or to doing the right thing. And a couple sentences, let me just read. Compromise, had to do with some of the movements such as the women's suffrage movement, the abolition of slavery, civil rights, the women's movement, and that these movements occurred because of sacrifice and suffering by ordinary people who did extraordinary things. And then you say, compromise was a word that did not exist in their dictionary. As Mahatma Gandhi said, great achievement is born of great sacrifice and is never the result of selfishness. But our legislative process is one of compromise, or supposed to be, because you have people who disagree on the means to get to certain ends. So what's your vision of what should have happened in terms of an Affordable Care Act if it had done the right thing?
Well, you're right. All the legislative process is about compromise. But if we really want reform, it's going to take everybody seeing that we're in this together. The path that we're on for health care, we just can't afford it.
Yeah.
The price for a family health insurance policy now is about $19,000 a year. That's, for a lot of families, that's a huge chunk of their income. So if we're going to be in this together, which I hope we will be, we have to figure out, how do we pare it back? How do we take out the things that don't add value to people's health so we have enough money to spend to take care of everyone? And it's going to take a different way of operating. It's not coming to see what it is that I can get, but how are we going to work this out together? What am I going to have to give? That would be really reform.
So at this point, do you believe the Affordable Care Act should be overturned?
I think that we need health care for everyone, and I think the issue is not the individual mandate. The whole issue is affordability. We have a mandate, but if it's not affordable for people, what good is it?
And you make some recommendations in the last chapter of your book. You have 10 steps to more affordable health care, truly more affordable. I'd like you to pick out your favorites of these and talk to our listeners a little bit about why they're so important.
Two things. One, which is so remarkable and still a conundrum for me, Diana, the amount of money that we waste on health care fraud. That would be enough money to cover 32 million uninsured people every single year. That's where we should begin. The good thing about the health care reform law, one good aspect of it is that it increased the amount of investment to curb the leakage, which is so profound, but it was a drop in the bucket. So there's plenty of money to take care of everybody. It's a question of how we're spending it to achieve the public's greatest health.
And why do you think they didn't invest more in it?
I think it's a really great question. Why do we allow all this leakage and fraud to take place? Not to be cynical, but the reality is that money benefits somebody. And we have a campaign contribution system that enables things that shouldn't be allowed to go on to continue, because it really is quite remarkable the amount of misuse of resources. So that's one thing. And secondly, we have to get to the point where we have negotiated drug prices. We give an example in the book of a drug for women who are at risk of delivering preterm. It used to be $400 a year, and the manufacturer made a little tweak to it. There was no grand discovery involved in it, and they ended up selling it for thousands and thousands of dollars.
I was stunned by how much it was. It was 1,000% increase,
and,
I think.
And the challenge in our healthcare system, and healthcare reform didn't fix this, is there's nothing to stop it.
There's
nothing to stop the increase. And I think in some ways, I'm sorry to say, healthcare has become predatory. And healthcare reform unleashed some of these bad things about the industry. So I wrote the book to help people understand, you know, what's driving it and what's now causing everybody having to pay really high deductibles and making it so unaffordable. On the track we're on, nobody will be able to afford it.
And let me just plug your prior book, because you do... bring some of that perspective into this current book. But your prior book was called The Treatment Trap, and we did. You were very gracious to come on Health Styles then and talk about that book, and it's very important. And I think it is helping certainly healthcare providers, particularly some of the physicians, to rethink what best practice ought to be and where are we overscreening and overtreating. So that book, The Treatment Trap, really laid out how we are over-treating, how we are over-screening, and that maybe we need, maybe you don't want every treatment imaginable.
Yeah, and that's a great point. And in fact, there's been a whole sequence here. The first book was on medical errors.
Yes.
And you peel back that onion, you try to understand, well, why is that happening? Well, it turns out a lot of people are getting medical treatment that they don't need, and in the course of that, bearing the consequences of medical mistakes. But then you have to ask the question, why are people being over-treated? Why are they getting surgeries that they don't need? Why are defibrillators and pacemakers being put in for people, many of whom don't need them? Well, it's because we have an industry that has to grow its revenue every year. It has to constantly meet Wall Street expectations for share price increases and earnings per share. So we have this dynamic pushing a lot of this, and I wrote The Battle Over Healthcare so we can help understand what it is that we're dealing with.
And let me just remind listeners, I'm talking with Rosemary Gibson, the lead author, the second author being J.P. Singh, in the new book, The Battle Over Healthcare, What Obama's Reform Means for America's Future, for America's Future, published by Roman and Littlefield. And Rosemary, you also have a recommendation that relates to a comment that you made earlier, and I'd like you to explain this. The recommendation is privatize the gains, privatize the losses. And earlier on in this interview, you mentioned what currently exists is that the industry, the pharmaceutical industry, the insurance industry, they privatize gains and socialize the losses. Explain that.
Let's take some examples of certain drugs, that we give this in The Battle Over Healthcare. So during the healthcare reform debate, the CEO of a major drug company was negotiating on behalf of the industry with the White House. At the same time, that drug company was in the crosshairs of the Justice Department that was working on a prosecution of this drug company. It was Pfizer, for inappropriate marketing of a drug. And the Justice Department, a few months later, slammed a $2.3 billion settlement on this one company. So, on the one hand, while we're negotiating, healthcare reform, at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, you have this same company and lead negotiator of that company being in the crosshairs of prosecution. And so what is it that brings us to this? And what happens as a consequence of the misuse of those drugs for which they were, criminally prosecuted? The consequence is people are harmed.
Yeah.
And who bears the cost?
Yeah.
Those costs are socialized. If you have a person in a nursing home, and my mother was in a nursing home for a while in New York, if she ever got a drug that she wasn't supposed to get and it caused her harm, who bears the consequence of that?
Yes.
Just the physical harm, let alone the cost of follow-up care. So we bear that. Society bears it. Meanwhile, the company privatizes its gain and socializes losses, just like the banks.
Yeah.
The banks made money, but when there were losses, who had to step in to pay for it? It was the taxpayer. We have the same thing in healthcare.
Rosemary, one of the things that actually surprised me about the book is you didn't speak much to some of the other elements of the Affordable Care Act, such as community health centers, expanding community health centers, expanding programs for home visitation of high-risk mothers, programs to keep older adults in their home out of nursing homes, supporting demonstrations or pilot projects on transitional care. How do you view those aspects of the Affordable Care Act?
I think those things are wonderful. There's also a provision in the Affordable Care Act to promote more geriatricians and geriatric nurse practitioners.
Yes.
But you know what? It's so small. Look how much money was spent to close the donut hole. And that will certainly benefit seniors, but it also benefits the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah.
But you know what? I believe that the greatest threat to the health of older Americans is that we don't have enough nurses, we don't have enough physicians mm-hmm. who are trained in the care of an older person. So mm-hmm. who's going to manage for these seniors all these medications that they're taking?
Yeah.
And we know geriatrics, unfortunately, is a wonderful, wonderful part of medicine and nursing. There's not enough of it. And in medicine, it appears to be declining.
Mm.
So we close the donut hole, but we don't put our resources into the people who can provide really good care to the growing number of seniors.
Mm. Yes.
Those are the anomalies that we have in healthcare reform. And it shows how industry-driven the outcome is.
Yeah. Well, we're almost out of time, and I'm highly interested in whether you think, regardless of the Supreme Court decision, you're hopeful that there are steps that we can take to really try to improve what we're doing with healthcare in this country.
I'm optimistic about the incredible energy of many nurses, physicians, to take advantage of opportunities that exist with good accountable care organizations, people who are deeply committed to do the right thing. They're out there working on it, more interprofessional care between physicians, nurses, social workers. That's exactly what healthcare should be all about and how it's designed. So that's what makes me optimistic. But we have this big hill to climb, and I hope by, you know, writing the battle over healthcare, at least we'll be able to understand what it will take to climb that hill.
Mm-hmm. And what's your next book?
A book on Medicare.
Ah, good. I knew you'd have one in your head.
Yeah, well, and how the choices just shouldn't be between, you know, putting the onus on seniors. That is just untenable. But I worry that that's what's going to happen.
What do you mean, putting the onus on seniors?
Well, there are certainly proposals out there. Congressman Ryan, for example, wants to basically voucherize Medicare. But what isn't coming out, and they're claiming, well, seniors, there's this culture of dependency. The reality is we have a culture of dependency of the healthcare industry, and nobody wants to talk about that, but I'm going to talk about it.
Well, Rosemary Gibson, your books are always very provocative, very eye-opening. I really do believe your work is helping to shift at least how healthcare professionals and others, the public as well, are thinking about healthcare and what we want in terms of healthcare, what it means, and how we need to get to a healthcare system that improves the health of the public, access to care, the right kind of care, as well as making care more affordable. So I want to thank you so much for coming on to Health Styles again to talk about your book. It is The Battle Over Healthcare, What Obama's Reform Means for America's Future, by our guest today, Rosemary Gibson and J.P. Singh, and it's published by Roman and Littlefield. Thank you so much, Rosemary.
Oh, thank you, Diana. It's on Amazon, and we donate proceeds for a good cause. Thank you again.
Great. And I'm Diana Mason. I'm with the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College that produces this program. You can follow us at the center at www.centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. That's centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. Thanks for listening.